it would be a doorway or a passageway for the kids to accept classical music, because they were being seduced by the rock and roll, you know, blues. <That's> and what was happening?
Right. I can't help thinking that this was all like a popular interpretation of McLuhan's "The Medium is the Message." I think the people right around the McLuhan was popular, and they were trying thought they were applying McLuhan.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway,
okay,
so
in this scene, I was going to ask you in the last session.
It was a really great time. I mean, there was a genuine feeling among all the hippie crowd of sharing and a certain amount of response and an attempt to communicate. Sex was open and free. Everybody shared everything, and it was just a really light, nice space to be in. But unfortunately, you know, as time went on, it began to lose that quality. And the mafia, the drugs, the heavies got involved and brought it all down. The hippies disappeared.
Yeah. Now you had a homosexual relationship with Connie, but in this period of the light shows, you meet a woman, and do you get married?
Not married. We live together.
What was her name?
Her name? Cindy.
Yeah. Cindy.
Cindy Shiver. She was working for Hair, that was playing in town.
Yeah.
Michael Butler Hair. And we did a light show for the opening party of the Hair party that was on Bainbridge Island, I believe. We had to take a boat to get there, and everybody was ripped and stoned. It was a real interesting night. Well, she saw me there and was attracted to, and later on I met her, and we started a connection, and one night I was with a friend of mine, a guy from Mexico, that we were actually at a politician's home on Lake Washington. He was the prosecuting attorney, and his daughters were friends of ours. We were connected with them through Annie Hawberg, who was the wife of the people that owned the largest sawmill in Seattle, in Washington. And she was loved all the artists and all the new people, and so she wooed us, and we became friends with hers, and really enjoyed Annie Hawberg, and her husband, you know, was the president of Weyerhaeuser, which was the logging industry, and she had daughters, and one that was kind of mentally challenged, and she used to drop the kid off with us for the afternoon and pick the kid up later. She trusted us, and we had a lot of interesting times and went to a lot of parties at her house over in Lake Washington. Well, one night I was at the home of one of her friends, who was a prosecuting attorney, and whose daughters we were friends with, and I was with a friend from Mexico. He was kind of like a friend of mine. And for some reason, I called Cindy up on the phone, and we were drunk. We had been drinking, really. And she said, "Why don't you come over?" So I said, "Okay." So my friend and I, we hopped in my van, and we drove over there. I don't know how we got there. We were really loaded. And that night, I spent the night with Cindy, and sort of made some connections, and the next few weeks I began to have strong feelings of towards her, and vice versa, and so we became friends, and eventually she moved in and lived with me for Yeah, 4 years, I guess it was. She was an artist. We had lots of things that we connected with and so forth. She was very sweet, very loving, and she later married an architect and lives in Seattle, Washington now.
Well, what happened to Connie at that time?
Well, Connie, I can only guess at what happened, but he started to really get involved with drinking wine, and he got involved with a girl, Maxine, who was a disc jockey on the FM station there that played the rock and roll music, and she had friends that were a little bit on the shady side, and a lot of cocaine was coming into Seattle, and Connie really liked cocaine, and I didn't like it at all, and we were growing apart. We were finding ourselves at ends with each other, and as he got deeper and deeper into drinking and into using cocaine, it became really apparent that we weren't able to stay together anymore, live together anymore, and eventually broke up our relationship in the light show, and I had to buy him out. I went to the bank, got a loan, and bought him out, and then I was running the light show by myself. Although we remained friends, I continually saw him and had, feelings of remorse and sadness about the direction he was going, but there was no way. It was very, very painful.
Speak more into the microphone.
Yeah, it was very painful to see him go down into the spiral of alcoholism. So
Sydney is with you. You said for 4 years.
Yeah.
Right now.
We moved to San Francisco later. So.
Yeah. So you go to San Francisco. Does Connie come to San Francisco with you?
Yeah. Now what happened was that after a few months, 3 months, 2 months went by, I was doing the light shows by myself, and I was doing them with John Morin, who was an artist, who was the poster artist of Seattle. And John was a friend of Connie's and mine, and so John was helping me with the light show, and Andy Nettemeyer and Clark Higgins, two students from the University of Washington, joined the light show. And by this time, Bill Duncan had left the light show due to some problems that we were having with him, personal problems. Anyway, and Bill went to San Francisco and went to work for McEwen Sound and headed their light show department. They had a kind of a light show business, slides, and they were doing slideshows. Bill was doing that.
Where was that at?
In San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so one day Connie called me up and said, could we get together and meet? And I said, sure. So I said, let's meet in the volunteer park. No, pardon me. The park that's near the University of Washington. There's a park there. I can't remember the name of it right now. Anyway, we met there and sat down on a bench someplace. And he told me how much he missed doing the lights and that he'd been trying to get his act together and so forth. And so I said, okay, Connie. I said, we can't live together. That's over. I said, but you can come back to work and work on weekends. And we'll take it from there. So that happened, and he came back to work. And that worked out for a while. We did the show at the Channel 7 together, and he was got very involved and focused on doing that show. It was something new. He liked the idea of television, and I did too. I thought it was a fantastic medium to work in. The idea was you could do something in a studio, and thousands of people were seeing it all over the city. That just really intrigued me. how you could affect a larger audience and so forth. So after we did the Channel 7 shows, we decided that let's go back to San Francisco. The light show thing is coming to an end here. I was doing some light shows at the Paramount Theater because the Eagles had closed. Boyd Grafmeyer left the Eagles Auditorium and was working for Northwest Releasing Company, which was a company that booked acts into town. They were very, very, very big in the Northwest. And he was working full-time with them. And there was another group of producers that were doing shows at the Paramount Theater. So we did a few shows at the Paramount, but it just, I don't know, we were growing out of the rock and roll scene. Just, it was dying out. So we gave a party, I remember, at our house, and a lot of all the people that we'd known and done business with, and the disc jockeys and all the people in the area came to our farewell party. And shortly after that, we packed up everything and headed south for San Francisco. And Cindy and I and a friend and drove back to San Francisco, and we stayed with Michael Woods, who was an artist and a close friend that I knew before I went to India. And Michael was doing posters and related psychedelic artwork in San Francisco now. But it too was, you know, coming to an end and so forth. So I returned to San Francisco, and I had a contract with to do some commercials for the Grateful Dead, some television spots. And so I needed a television station or studio equipment to wed the components together. So we shot part of it on film, and we needed to make tapes of it. So I asked around if there's any stations that could do this kind of thing, and all the stations in San Francisco were all too busy with their own production needs and weren't, you know, renting out space. Someone said there's a station called Chemo that isn't operating, but someone's there, and they thought the equipment was available, and they might help us. So I found Chemo, drove over, and met the engineer in charge, and told him what I wanted to do. He said he would ask his boss. He got back to me. He said, yeah, we could do it there. So for the next day, we worked there, using the equipment, and wedded the commercials together. And then I found out that Leon Crosby owned the station. He had just bought it, and he used to own the rock and roll station that was popular in San Francisco. So immediately I took a meeting with him and tried to find out what he was doing, and he didn't really know. He was trying to get the station back on the air, and he was dealing with the FCC and you know, all the legal apparatus that was there. And so he said, well, just hang out here, just stay here. And he gave me an office there and said, you can have an office here and we'll see what happens. That was his way he operated, you know, very, very clever. Anyway, we stayed there, we had our office, and so our little group, that was Cindy, Michael Woods, myself, Connie, Clark, and Andy, and Bruce, a friend.
Not Bill Duncan, no.
And so we had a good-sized office there, and there was film equipment there. And gradually, when the station got open, they started to use our services. But there was another fellow there that was operating the production department, and he was a director. And so naturally there was a little bit of a rift going on between us. You know, he knew we wanted to be in his position, and we did. And there was a little bit of a struggle there. But eventually, it came to pass that Leon asked me if I would take the job of production manager and use my crew as the staff. And we said, yeah, we would do it. And I said, but we're going to join the union, and we have to get union scale, and so forth. And a lot of hankering and bickering went on, and finally he agreed. So we joined the Television Arts ICCI. That's the bank here in India. Anyway, we took over operating the station, and we stayed there for some time, and eventually, you know, started creating shows of our own. I was program director too. I had a dual job there. And so, you know, we did the Chicken Little show, which was a pre-runner of Saturday Night Live. Some of the writers in the Chicken Little show were the writers for Saturday Night Live in New York. And not that they created it, they were just on the staff. But we definitely had an impact on the television scene in San Francisco. I met Pete Marino, who was the rep for Warner Brothers, and we did a show with him. And also, Mort Feld, who was one of the owners of McEwen Sound, did a show. Something Else Again, it was called. And we had a sex show. But all kind. We had a movie channel at night with the old sourdough. And two guys did that show. They were from another station in San Jose, and they moved up and took over and did a show out in Kimo, a movie show. And so it was, you know, there was Spanish novellas on, there were Russian, German, a little bit of everything. It was a potpourri mixture, hippies, everything was going on. And of course, that it was crazy, demanding, and at times very difficult to cope with the craziness.
Here's what it says on Googling Kimo TV. It says, UHF Nocturne, The Lost Worlds of Late Night TV. Were you on UHF?
Yeah.
Right. And it says, Kimo TV 20. San Francisco's Kimo TV 20 was for a few years in the late 60s and very early 70s. Did you start there about 71, 72?
70 or 71 it was about.
Okay.
So it was on independently of for some years, and then they sold it to Leon Crosby.
Okay, so what it says here says in the late 60s, very early 70s, it was the coolest station to ever broadcast in the Bay Area. They were laughably low budget. One consequence of their poverty was that their programming was unique, to say the least. In Kimo TV's earliest and likely best capitalized period, I think this is before you, they relied heavily on syndicated fare such as a three-hour talk show, Cup Show with Irv Kupcinet, and Hugh Hefner's Playboy After Dark. It was in this incarnation that they also ran foreign films on Monday nights under the banner The Adults Only Movie. And
yeah, that was before us.
Right, so it says Kimo, and it mentions horror films on Shakatumi Theater on Saturday nights with the Bay Area's second most obscure horror host, Asmodeus. Did you ever meet Asmodeus?
I did meet him, yeah.
But that was before you. So then it says Kimo TV disappeared. Yeah, it disappeared for a while around late 71 and early 72. Now that must be when you showed up.
Yeah.
In limbo, early 72. They may have been on the air part of that time, but were not listed in the TV guide. When they returned, it was with a mix of foreign language programming in the early evenings. Is that your period?
Yep.
And an erratic parade of locally produced weirdness in the early, late, and late night hours.
Oh, boy.
and, that's a result of Bob Carr, right? This is Bob Carr as director, or you and the other people, right? It says, during this period, the station broadcast some of the most entertaining and or bizarre local shows ever seen. The sourdough and Whatcha Kanoka hosted old westerns while delivering hilarious humor as a couple of old West characters. The Chicken Little comedy show provided a local sketch comedy reminiscent of the Fireside Theater and Congress of Wonders.
Yeah.
Were you the director during that period?
No, I was production. I was just a production manager of the station, and I just oversaw I just allowed them to do their thing, you know. They would come and tape late at night, all hours of the night. They had a very low budget, but very creative people. Stuart Birnbaum was one of the writers and actors. Later he went to Hollywood, and he had a brother down there in Hollywood. He also was in New York with the Saturday Night Live. I think he's still connected to Hollywood now. But, it was very creative and low budget. we did one show, with Channel 9, PBS. We did one show in connection with them in that they did the audio feed and we did the visual feed. And the audio feed was in quadraphonic sound. And we were doing stereo broadcast at that time, which wasn't done. You know, no one knew how to do it. We figured out how to do it. We used the control track on the VTRs for the second audio channel.
And so you would mix, like, you would provide visuals to a soundtrack that you didn't know anything about?
No. I mean, we had live sound, live rock and roll, Doobie Brothers, Mahlo, I can't remember all the bands, but any band that came to town that was a Warner Brothers band, Pete would bring down to the studio and we'd do a show with them, a promotional show. Do you remember Divine, Lady Divine?
Yeah, John Waters.
Yeah. Well, Divine used to come down to the station and hang out, and I thought, Jesus, what's this? So we just encouraged Divine to stay out, hang out, you know, just to add to the weirdness.
Right. And this is before, I mean, her movie comes out in 72, 73. This is just before her famous dog shit eating movie comes out.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, you're 44 at this time. You're born 1928. You're 44 years old.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back just to the points here. It says the guy that you competed with, who was director of the place, he drops off, but you don't become his position. You're just production.
Yeah, manager. I take his job over. He's gone. He's out. Over. Finished.
Well, in that sense, then this is you. I mean, you didn't create all this stuff, but you were the stabilizing the person who had to be responsible for things in the background of all this.
He was only there a few months, and then was gone, and two or three months, and then whatever it was, could be longer, a little bit longer. But he was gone, and we took over the programming, but you know. Like in radio or television, you work with the sales team who are out there selling time, and whatever the buyer wants, you put on. We were selling hours of television time for amounts of various amounts of money. They could put on their own show. All we did was produce it, and help direct it. Oftentimes they didn't know how to direct, you know.
Yeah.
So. Well, there were a lot of strange shows.
Okay. Here's a couple other titles. One was called It's About Sex.
Yeah.
And another one called Swingle Scene.
Yeah.
And that went beyond the tease of the Adults Only movie to be the Bay Area's first and to date only television dedicated to recreational sex.
Yeah.
Then there was a show called The Worst of Hollywood. It was a hosted movie show dedicated to Poverty Row and B films of the 30s and 40s. And toward the end of this brief golden age of obscure TV, a carpet salesman named Leon Heskett. You remember that name?
Yeah, 3M Carpets.
Yeah, hosted all-night movies and inadvertently gave Bob Wilkins a running gag that would last him for years.
Yeah, Carpets.
Do you know what that...
Yeah, I can't forget that. But, no, that was the old sourdough show. The old sourdough was the show that MM Carpets was doing.
Sponsored, I see.
Yeah, we did car... You know, I got a car out of the deal. A Dodge
Sports. Well, what was the running gag that was given to Bob Wilkins? You know?
No, I don't know that. So.
Okay, so it continues. It says Chemo TV. It said Chemo TV didn't last long in that format. Within a couple of years, they were mainly foreign language with some late night programming cropping up once in a while. Jim Gabbert bought the station in the early 80s and brilliantly remade it into KOFY TV with a format that has since been very successful on a national scale as TV Land.
Right. Gabbert did a great thing. He was a real... He created the first stereo FM music show in San Francisco back in, well, at 64 or 5, whenever stereo came out on radio.
Okay, so he comes in. Now, the guy writing this article says, of all the lost worlds of late night TV, I miss the old Chemo TV 20 the most.
Yeah, it was strange. There was everything. We had Indian music, Indian dancing, ballet, rock and roll, blues, jazz, any celebrity that came to town. I have to get back to it. My brain just died.
Mark somebody?
Yeah, no, not Mark. Mark. It's Martin Mull.
Martin Mull. See, Martin Mull.
The computer works. Just slow. Martin Mull was working at the boarding house, and I went to see him, and I said, why don't you come down to Chemo, and do a show? And he said, sure, And that's how I met Martin Mull, and later we did some work with him at Warner Brothers. But anybody, anywhere that was in town, we would approach them. And I remember when some of the early rock and roll bands that had dropped out and then made a comeback would, show up in San Francisco and Chemo would give them, time to tell about their comeback and so forth. So...
Do you remember Melvin Belli? They have a picture here. He had a show on Chemo.
Yeah, it must have been after me.
After or before, right. They call him the king of torts, T-O-R-T-S.
Yeah, Melvin Belli.
Okay, now, here's what's interesting. You're as a magician. You did spiritual magic as a channel. You did chemical magic with LSD. You then did poster art printing magic in San Francisco. Then you did a light show magic or hypnotism. And then now you're doing TV magic. But there's one little point here. If we go back to 69-70, that is when Dave Worster took me, I don't know if Carolyn was there, went over and we were at your house. And I think Connie was there. I remember Dave Worster and I sitting there, and Connie and Robert, and it was a stilted evening. There was a strain.
Where was it?
At your place, wherever you were living in 69. I don't know. I didn't know Seattle that well. I don't know where Dave drove me.
Oh, in Seattle. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, then I was living over on off of 45th Street, in a brick house, a big, you know, big house.
Is that in the university district? What's known as the
Yeah.
That's the area
all
where
sat on the floor.
Yes.
Everything was on the floor, and there was a Japanese screens and Indian art and very psychedelic looking place.
Exactly. And in other ways, in some ways, like the design in the center 10 years before, right?
Yeah. Can't help it.
And I remember you with your fuzzy, bushy hair, you know, long, bushy, fuzzy, furry, I guess, you know, like a small afro kind of effect, I think.
Yeah. And curly hair, so.
Yeah, and I remember, I don't know how much David told me about you, his relationship with you, but you were someone important. It was the only time, I don't know if this could be distorted memory, but I remember sitting there, and there was a respect going on between you and him, but a problem was in there. There was a strain, and I think I knew that you were into Krishnamurti and you didn't respect mediumship. So I remember feeling the strain that night, but you did take us upstairs or some other part of the house, and you showed us the slides or whatever it was that were your gimmicks in the show, the light show.
Yeah, we had a production room, large room where we did the work. Well, the thing about David is that, David came to the center and he was, you know, like a student studying, you know, listening to me talk and he's bright, very bright guy, and gradually he started, you know, to take on his own responsibility and to figure things out for himself, and he was, you know, introduced me to Elliot Craig, who did my first LSD trip, and so forth. And David and I got along fine. I think this strain that we're talking about is that after Doobie died and David started channeling this so-called cosmic awareness, that I begin to feel, David, you don't need to do this. You can talk yourself. You don't need a gimmick,
right?
And I think that was the tension that you felt.
No, that was it. I knew that much. I knew that because around that time, either before I met you or after, you spoke somewhere in Seattle, and Paul Seibel and Worcester and everybody went and saw you speak, and it seemed to me in a basement place or something. And so you retrieved your guru self and talked about Krishnamurti. It was more of a Krishnamurti talk.
I did talk at the University of Washington in one of their classrooms, which was in a building, in one of the, you know, a large classroom.
Yeah, that's where it was.
Yeah. David did invite me to come to Stanford University, where there was a conference being held. Students organized this. The university didn't. It was a student operation, and it was. And I remember also that Alan Noday was invited. Alan came and stayed with me in Seattle for a week. Alan was Krishnamurti's secretary for a number of years. He was a South African, and I met him first in Sanan in 1966, and didn't see him again until he came to visit me in Seattle. We got in contact somehow, and he was sort of on his own. He wanted to experiment and give talks. So I said, well, come to Seattle. I can arrange some talks at the University of Washington, which I did, and also at a university in Bellingham, a college there, through some friends. At that time, it was really easy to get, you know, guest speakers were sought after, but by the students, you know, and anything that had to do with spirituality was with people who were interested in it and so forth. So Alan came and stayed with me at the house. At that time, I gave him my room, and I went over and I stayed with Cindy. So I knew Cindy then, and this is before Cindy had moved in with me. She didn't. We didn't move, stay together until we moved in together in San Francisco. But Alan was having problems with the Krishnamurti. They had asked him to leave due to some, you know, they didn't want to get involved with Alan. They claimed he overstepped his boundaries. The truth never came out. And I asked Alan, I tried to pry it out of him, what happened? And he was reluctant, so I said, okay, all right. Then I won't push you anymore. I am a gentleman to some degree. But I got it, what happened. Alan was gay, and he had invited a lot of young men to stay in a chalet and promised that Jay Krishnamurti would come and visit them and give talks to them, primarily to them, special. And this never happened. Mary Zimbalist, when she got wind of it, she flew into a rage and told Krishnaji that this would hurt Krishnaji's reputation, and Alan, there was a rift going on between her and Alan. So
because she didn't like the fact he brought gay people in. That was the fact.
Well, they weren't gay. They weren't gay people. They were just young men, you know, handsome young men, you know.
But what was her problem with him having Krishnamurti speak to them? What was her problem about that?
Because she knew Alan was. Well, she knew that Alan was gay.
So she had a problem with the fact he was gay.
Yeah. And here she's from Hollywood, you know, steeped in the Hollywood scene, you know. Husband, yeah. A famous producer. But all this had followed. I mean, Leadbeater was gay, and there was a problem in the Theosophical Society with Leadbeater and his activities. Yeah. And he was asked to leave. He was kicked out of the society, but eventually he was reinstated.
After Krishnamurti had left,
gay was really a sin, you know, back in the at that time.
Yeah, I mean, he was reinstated after Krishnamurti left.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyways, Alan is replaying the Leadbeater problem. But you think she's suspicious? So Zimbalist, Mary Zimbalist is suspicious of a gay guy bringing over these handsome men and getting Krishnamurti in that environment.
Yeah.
Well, something
just
like
the
that.
Fact that Alan, just the fact that Alan was promising these men that they would have a special meetings with J.K. You know, he was overstepping his bounds, you know, so to speak. But at that time, Krishnamurti was very interested in talking at universities, going here, going there. He even asked Yuji to write a letter for him to get introduced to a college in Madras so he could be invited to give talks there. And Yuji wrote a beautiful letter, just a beautiful letter about Krishnamurti to the staff at the college. And as far as I know, J.K. was invited to come. But J.K. was trying to get invitations all over the world.
That's when he hooked up with David Bohm, you know, the British physicist.
Yeah.
And he had these academic or semi-academic...
Right. Yeah, he wanted to appear with bona fide, you know, accepted people, psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, physicists, scientists, people that were, you know, mobile, I mean, that were, you know, accepted by the world. Because J.K. wanted to be accepted as a spiritual teacher, as a real, you know, philosopher, not just a guru from India.
That's right. And at that time in the early 70s, the baby boomers were going into the yuppie phase. They dropped back in and were trying to be respectable. So Krishnamurti was following within the yuppie trend. He was trying to be reconnect and be a drop-in rather than a drop-out.
And he did. He did successfully, you know.
Yes. Now, back to that meeting. So I remember the tension between David and you. Now, I like David, and I remember thinking, nah, that guy Carr, no, he's no fun. I'm going to hang out with Dave Worster. At least he goes in trance and does interesting things. So I remember thinking of you, and, you know, I didn't know you, but my image of you was you were a little too Puritan and maybe old-fashioned. I don't know. I saw Krishnamurti as a bit old-fashioned. I thought that what Dave was doing was sort of something new. Now,
J. Krishnamurti was old-fashioned. The whole thing was, you know, very carefully staged, worked out, very methodical, you know. Very, very, you know, you had to give up your opinions to listen to and just find out what was happening. But anyway, yeah, Krishnamurti was old-fashioned. But he was born. Look when he was born, you know.
Yeah, and so I thought that you were too much involved with Krishnamurti, and yeah, I remember going to one Eagles Auditorium show. There was a light show, so it was probably you guys, but I don't remember going backstage and seeing you guys. I'd be with David probably. But I didn't know all the media work orchestra and the TV. I didn't know that. It didn't come across. And you would have been doing it by that time, 69, early 70, yeah. Right?
Yeah. We did a light show for the mayor's inaugural ball. That's what happened. It was a complete turnaround, you know, from being the evil hippies from Berkeley to being accepted by the city fathers, you know. And
right.
Hobnobbing with the ultra-rich. You know, the Hobbergs.
and definitely the Hobbergs. How do you spell that?
I'm not sure how you spell it. Look at my book.
Right, but the thing is that in that sense,
it's German name.
Yeah, in that sense, I wasn't aware of it. Dave was the underground. You guys were the successful, but we did not meet within the context of your entertainment. Hypnotism. We met within the context of metaphysical wizardry in the Krishnamurti, the gobbledygook thing, right? And so it was like a meeting in a way. With meeting with Dave that I witnessed was like a meeting with your past and the old Seattle scene.
And maybe that's what I didn't want to be, you know, involved with that past anymore.
Right,
although I was creating a new image. You know, a bit of a guru myself, you know, I ask myself, what is that desire in us to communicate with others, to pass on what we know? Like a poet has inspiration, writes poetry, then he wants to pass it on to someone else, you know. Filmmaker wants to share his vision. Artists want to paint, sell their art. Have it recognized. What is this desire to communicate? You're a communicator. What is it?
Yeah, well, we said earlier, it might have been on the CKLN interview, I remember saying this earlier today or something. We were talking about, it was on CKLN, the instinct for sex and for food, and then I added communication. There's actually three major instincts in humans, sex, food, or desires or needs or survival. Sex, food, and communication. That's what you're describing.
Well, I think the communication is for survival, based on that. If I can communicate with the guy, he's not going to club me.
Yeah.
So, it's part of the survival instinct, but it's an interesting development in human consciousness that we have this urge to share, you know?
Yeah, you could say that Karl Marx dealt with the food, class, work production battle. Freud discovered the sex instinct, and McLuhan developed the communication factor in human history.
Yeah.
And then Krishnamurti talks about the private citadel of consciousness, the soul, the something that is not so involved with the sex, food, instinct. It's the doubleness, the detached part of this consciousness that is wondering what the heck's going on, you know, while it's trapped in the instinct. You know what I mean? That's the area you're interested in, the philosophy.
Yeah,
metaphysical.
Yeah. I can't help it. I'm philosophical in my. I'm dated, I guess.
I see you're not things philosophical. In a philosophical.
Yeah.
You're not philosophical. You're self-conscious. Whatever level you want to put into that meaning. You're self-conscious. You're looking at yourself while you're doing things.
Right.
Yeah. So I meet you then, and then around that time you gave the talk, and the talk was okay, but it was about old stuff. For some reason it didn't attract me. And then Carol and I left Seattle by March 70, and that was when you were dominant in the Seattle scene, and you're going to be there for about another year, and then you go to San Francisco in 71. And it was in the summer of 71, early 72, or in that period when Worcester was having those talks at Stanford that you would have performed at.
Right, yeah. I went down there and had a good time. I stayed with some friends of David, and it was interesting, to frustrating at the same time, because you want to get your point across and you're not sure, you know, the point was, you know, people got it. I've seen this kind of frustration with J. Krishnamurti, you know, end of a talk, the series, he'll say, well, I don't know if you got it.
Yeah.
I've seen UG. Go ahead.
I've seen those in videotapes of Krishnamurti. I mean, halfway through the talk, you'll say, "Is anybody listening? What's wrong with you people?" You know, the frustration would come out in the middle of the talks and at the end. Yeah. And you're saying about UG.
Yeah, he had a similar thing. He would just say, "Well, I know you didn't understand a word I said, so."
Well, see, from the McLuhan level, the frustration with verbal communication, which you're getting all the time from the late 50s into going to India, and you leave Krishnamurti in 67, you think you've got him, and you go. Well, what you did, you got involved in post-verbal media. You got into the light show and then in television. You know, you were lucky that was there to assuage your frustration. You got into new media.
I think what happens... when you have contact with people like JK or UG, they throw you back on yourself, you know? And I came back from India, and what was it I wanted to do? I wanted to be involved with the creative process, you know? I wanted to create something. And so the light shows was happening at that time. And so I took advantage of that and explored that and developed it, threw myself into it. And from that light show television and on, you know, so forth, and film.
Well, you're not just a philosopher, you're an artist.
Yeah. Yeah, I have some artistic bent.
Yeah, you painted when you were a kid, right?
When I was young, I painted in San Francisco. I did quite a lot of work and a lot of paintings in San Francisco, and prior to that, also in Portland, when I was just back from my magic show days, I was doing a lot of painting, experimenting with art. And then eventually in San Francisco, I transferred the brush to the canvas or to the silver screen, to the big screen. Now I became a light painter. So I never left this artistic thing. Never left, you know. I just got a bigger screen.
Right, but that was 10 years later. You oscillated between verbal communication, which would be the philosopher part of yourself, and the artistic light manipulation part of yourself. And you see these phases. You were lucky. You got frustrated with the verbal by the end of 66, early 67. You felt you got it. Now you wanted to flip back into your artist side. And you do your artist side for many years. And then when you're in San Francisco and after Chemo TV, you become a restaurant person.
Yeah. Again, I want to just say back that that you get thrown back onto yourself, onto what you are. And what I am is I have an artistic background nature, and that needed to come out, needed to express itself. So it expressed itself. And now people say, why did you come to India, Bob? Why are you in Mumbai? And I say, because I want to express something here. I'm expressing something now. This is what right. I want to express.
But the philosopher, you get thrown back into your artistic instinct, but you're yeah. thrown back by verbal encounters.
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah, yeah, or something beyond the verbal, yeah.
right, something beyond the verbal.
That's what I'm getting at. Something there behind the words, not the words, but the energy behind the words.
Yeah, so you make this connection with the Peter guy connected to Warner Brothers, which leads you to Desi Arnaz Jr., which leads yeah. you into Hollywood, and a whole running around with that, and then that becomes frustrating, and then you go into the restaurant, and then in the late 70s, you flip back into the verbal when you meet UG in 79. That was the big turning point. It's called yeah. that in your book.
Yeah,
and it's a turning point back to the verbal philosopher post-thought thing in yourself. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Almost the post, you know, not being creative, just looking yeah. at everybody else trying to be creative. But I jumped through a lot of hoops there.
I consider this is, I mean, we can go into what is creativity and creativity, you know, etc. But I think maybe, Bob, this might be a good time for us to end this chapter, and we can start with a new one.
Okay. There was one lingering thing. I wanted to ask you,
okay,
in,
sure.
in 72, 73, you had the hip surgery, was it?
The 74.
Yeah, you had some hip surgery, right?
74.
Okay, so and that's when you've met Desi, so that's where we'll pick up yeah. from that point. That's where we'll go.
Yeah, and then from that, eventually, the breaking up my relationship with Cindy, too.
Right. Happened. Okay.
The hip surgery and Cindy happened simultaneously.
Okay. So we had very good, and so we will end this with a prayer to Dafri John, Baba
what?
John.
What? Good riddance. Good riddance.
Yeah, good riddance. That's our prayer. Good riddance. Okay.
Good riddance. Send him on his way.
Yeah, we pray for the souls on the other dimensions who are now having to deal with him. And there's all.
Yeah, there's all. Okay.
Okay, right, thanks a lot, Bob. Great, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.